piece of bright news from the Trade Secretary on the 9th of September. He says the worst of the recession in Britain is over and he can now expect a modest recovery. Now that was the 9th of September 1981, John Biffin. 2 days later, £2.6 billion had been wiped from the value of the British companies on the stock exchange. In fact, the very nature of the present social system is that it is unpredictable in its ups and downs. Now, when James Prior was Employment Secretary in 1981, he was rather more honest. In fact, so honest that he was sacked. He said, "Frankly, I don't know what the forecasts will show or what the results will be in 3 years' time. The point is that all governments pretend to be in control, but are in fact governed themselves by market forces. In modern society, there are only two classes, those who possess real wealth and therefore don't work to produce any, and the overwhelming majority who possess nothing but our ability to work, which we are therefore forced to spend our lives selling or trying to sell in order to survive. Now, the tiny minority who are not in the position of being wage slaves are well aware of it. For example, a television documentary some time ago interviewed a man called Rupert Dean. He said, "Daddy never worked, nor have I. I have various businesses. Speaking personally, the recession doesn't affect me at all because I'm not employed." Take, for example, the diary column in the Tatler, which is one of those magazines which really belongs on the top shelf with some of Mary Whitehouse's favourites. Says there in the diary column of this high society magazine, David Liddell Granger and Lady Christine de la Rue, they even have more names than the rest of us, gave a shooting weekend party, very civilised shooting, at David's home, Eyton Castle. Heard the phrase, an Englishman's home is his castle, in this case an Englishman's castle is his home, in Berwickshire. I flew up with Brian Stein in his Cessna Golden Eagle, and unfortunately, because of the thick fog, we were obliged to land at Newcastle and motor the final 40 miles to Eyton Castle. Well, that was very unfortunate. I don't know if you popped into the Printer's Pie whilst you was here. But at the same time, you've got the recent report from Bristol University, based in the North East, showing that in the north of England, over the past year, there are 1,500 needless deaths and 14,000 permanent handicaps, which could have been avoided were it not for the bad living conditions in the area. And the response of Norman Tebbit over the weekend to that news was that, and I quote, "The north of England's economic wounds are self-inflicted." You remember we had lectures recently from Edwina Curry on the question of diet. Well, we've had the curry, presumably now this is the chips to go with it from Norman Tebbit. Now, you've got to be careful, however, if you are unemployed and you follow Edwina's advice and you become healthy. Because if you're healthy and on the dole, then you are suspect. In fact, the DHSS issues some guidelines for spotting social security scroungers, and they include, quotes, "a suspiciously high standard of living and apparent good health and fitness," and you're suspect. No doubt, therefore, the DHSS is going to be investigating both Rupert Dean and his daddy. So what have we got then? The capitalist system, social system, is a concrete reality, you can't escape from it in your mind, which exists in every country in the world today. And it's based on two or three simple principles which I'm going to spend some time going through. Capitalist system. Firstly, there is a minority class in every country which owns and controls all of the wealth-producing resources. In one form or another, they own the factories, the farms, the docks, the mines, the newspapers, the transport. Whether it's the private shareholders in private companies, or whether it's the state bureaucracy in the case of British coal and in the case of the Russian Empire, makes no difference. The fact is, whether it's private capitalism or state capitalism, you've got that basic division where a minority act as parasites, controlling and owning, effectively, all of the wealth-producing machinery for their own benefit. In fact, it's a worldwide system, and every morning the price of diamonds is fixed on a telephone hotline between Moscow and Johannesburg. It's an open secret, so much for the political opposition between those regimes. Secondly, apart from its class division, in capitalist society across the world today, Production is geared to profitable sales in the marketplace. Not to satisfy human needs, first and foremost. That just happens by accident, if you're lucky. It's geared towards selling at a profit. That's what production is based on. And if profits dry up, then, as you well know, production ceases, whether you like it or not. And further, most importantly, it's based on a power relationship between the boss and the worker in every scrap of the earth. Now, this power relationship, which says that the boss shall control the whole of society and the worker shall simply be his slave, his wage slave, is a power relationship. But the boss we work for cannot clearly consume 1,000 cars per week. He can't live on, for example, 1,000 cars which we produce for him. Therefore, in order to exercise his privileges, he has to sell those cars and turn them into cash. And therefore, the domination of society by that minority, their domination, is expressed through the limitations of their market system. When they find that they can't sell what we have made for them, then it's tough. Everything closes down. And that is simply an example of how their interests dominate, in the most pathetic of ways, the whole of the world's existence. Now, between these two classes, there can obviously be no harmony, there can be no agreement, there cannot be any kind of working together. There's a class struggle, whether you recognise it or not, you're forced right into it from the day you're born, between these two classes. Whether it's a case of a strike, whether it's a lockout, whether it's a dispute over your rent, whether it's simply struggling to pay the fuel bills. That is the class struggle which we're all engaged in, regardless of our political views. And the main feature of capitalism that is relevant tonight, as we discuss the crisis of capitalism, is the periodic mass unemployment. Now, over the past few hundred years that capitalism has existed, there have been massive slumps in trade, and therefore massive rises in unemployment, time and again, in the late 19th century, in the 1930s, and again in the 1980s. And all of the evidence shows that these ups and downs, the booms of the 60s and the slumps of the 80s, are an inevitable feature of capitalist society. That's why they've been with us for hundreds of years. They're part of its breathing in and breathing out, for a very simple reason, that capitalism is based upon competition over profit, and that at certain times, certain industries overproduce for their market, not for human needs, of course, plenty of needs will go unmet, but for the cash demand, they overproduce for their market, and therefore they start to cut back. And it happens time and again, and therefore the whole process of capitalist growth has to be periodically arrested so that the capital values can be destroyed, so that factories can be closed down and smashed down in order to restore the high rate of profit that they once enjoyed so they can go back to square one. Now, these strange mechanisms are part of the natural working of the capitalist system, and it would be naive in the extreme for anyone to claim that they can work capitalism without these ups and downs, because they've been with us and they will continue to be with us as part of that system. Now, capitalism, therefore, is based upon production for profit and not human need. And this leads to the most obscene contradictions. And I'm only going to have time to point to one or two. I'd like to be able to point to many more. At the moment, according to official figures, there is one person who dies of starvation every other second. And yet, at the same time, the United Nations, hardly a revolutionary body, tells us that the world has the resources to feed several times the world's population. So why do they starve? And then you take the following quotation from the paper a week ago. It says that in Europe there are 20 million tons of unwanted grain, butter and beef. 20 million tons. And they say it's unwanted when one person is dying of starvation every second. They've got to be insane to write these words. And the European Parliament is setting up a commission to investigate, and I quote, not only how to get rid of the food mountains, but also how to ensure, through price policy and production controls, that they never reappear. That's the kind of priorities we're dealing with in a capitalist society, whether it's in one of its booms or whether it's in one of its inevitable slumps, which it has from time to time. One other example I'll squeeze in. Every winter in Britain, tens of thousands of old people die of the cold. There are dozens of reports to prove this, that the rate of deaths amongst old people is much higher in the winter because of the cold. They can't afford decent heating as well as food. And yet, of course, you have the closure of pits, a cutting back on supplying fuel, purely for reasons of finance and profit, in an industry that's nationalised. Only a couple of days ago in the paper, British Coal, it says, confirmed the closure of Cadby Colliery near Doncaster, rejecting the advice of an independent review body that it had a moral obligation to keep the pit open. Now, of course, I'm sorry to have to say it, but the British Coal Board on that occasion was right on one point. It doesn't have a moral obligation, because we live, whether we like it or not, at present, in a capitalist society. And it's for us to change that. But whilst we do live in a capitalist society, it would be stupid of us to expect the capitalists to act with any kind of morality and to defend working class interests. For example, Alan Sugar, the boss of the Amstrad Computer Company, was quoted in International Management as saying, and I quote, "If there was a market in mass-produced portable nuclear weapons, we'd market them too." There's no morality. Don't waste your time looking for it. What you're living in is a world dominated by the profit of the few, and it would be futile to try to persuade those profit mongers to run that system in the interests of all. Futile. And therefore we have to start arguing about how we get rid of that system, not how we patch it up in any shape or form. Now I want to go back at this stage to the 19th century because there was a very lively debate at the end of the 19th century. Thousands of workers like ourselves engaged in a very heated national debate. And that debate was between two policies which the workers could adopt to solve their problems. And that debate needs to be revived tonight. It's a debate between reform and revolution, and it was very passionate. Now, the idea of reform grew up in the 19th century from the capitalists themselves, because realising that the repression that they exercised when they killed a dozen workers at Peterloo for trying to exercise free speech was not going to be a policy which would keep them in power forever, because obviously workers start to fight back. And so in the late 19th century, they themselves, the capitalists, decided to go for softer policies. For example, Lord Milner, in 1906, said the attempt to raise the well-being and efficiency of the more backward of our people is not philanthropy, it is business. And the very same year, 1906, and it's ironic, I'll be coming on to this later, it happens to also be the year of the birth of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and there'll be some connection between these facts. In 1906, an American employer wrote a letter in the Chicago Daily News in which he tried to justify his policy of providing benefits for his workers. Some of his fellow bosses were a bit shirty. They said, you can't start providing benefits for the scum. And he wrote a letter in 1906, year of the birth of the Labour Party. He said, "When I keep a horse and I find him a clean stable and good food, I am not doing anything philanthropic for my horse." But it just shows you the contempt that we're held in by our employers. And it shows you where reform begins and ends, the idea to placate, to run the system efficiently. And workers were faced with a dilemma. Do we go along with that, or do we demand more? Do we demand a revolution in society? Now, the Socialist Party of Great Britain was founded 2 years before the Labour Party on a very, very clear platform. One of its early slogans was, no compromise, of class struggle. And our concern from the very first moment was to win the class struggle, not to lose it. And the view of the Socialist Party still remains to this day completely unchanged. But in order to win the class struggle once and for all, the workers have got to organise collectively, politically and industrially, and have got to say to the bosses, we're not interested in running your system in some other way. We're not interested in that system at all. And right from the start, socialism was defined very clearly, and I'm going to define it now. Socialism means a worldwide society in which wealth is produced purely for use and not for profit. Because the productive machinery, all of the resources, would be owned and controlled in common. In other words, there would be a democracy, a true democracy in society, in which the whole of the human race, doesn't matter what is your sex or your race or your age, the whole of the human race would be the joint owners in common of the planet Earth and all of its resources and industry and agriculture and transport and communications. And on that basis, we can start to produce wealth purely for free use, to meet needs according to people's own decisions about their needs, rather than trying to produce capitalist commodities which have to be bought and sold in the marketplace. So no longer would you have to close a pit for economic reasons. No longer would you have to have 85,000 homeless families in Britain when you've got the biggest brick surplus since the war. Because instead, you would put two and two together and you would start to build houses for people to live in and make food for people to eat purely because there were people who wanted to live in them, regardless of the idea of these people having something called money to prove that they deserve to have those houses. Now, obviously, the definition of socialism can be taken in more detail during the discussion period. But that was the idea right from the start. Production for use, not profit, and common ownership of the world's resources, not private ownership. And right from the start, we made it clear that the idea of the state taking over industries was simply another form of private ownership. Because the state is a class body. The miners during the miners' strike learnt that 10 times over. And therefore, to put the industry in the hands of the state, as was done in the coal industry in 1947, is clearly a crass error on the part of the working class if we expect that industry to be run by us and for us, together with the rest of the world. If I can quote from the first ever Socialist Party manifesto, which was first published 80 years ago and is still valid, they said that to change society, workers must give up the superstition that the robbers, that's the bosses, can be friendly to the robbed. Can't be friendly to the robbed, and therefore there can be no compromise with them. And right from the start, we were a movement of democracy. That you have to develop conscious political ideas as a class, and then you put them to action democratically by sending mandated delegates to all of the elected bodies of the world in order to transform society democratically. So it's a revolution of the ballot box, but even before that, and more importantly, it's a revolution of the brain box, because we need a revolution in people's ideas if we're going to get rid of the old form of society and bring in the new. Now, I want at this point to turn back to the Labour Party, which I've just mentioned as having been founded in 1906. Now, right from the start, let's be clear about this, the Labour Party was never a party for socialism or for any kind of radical change. Never was, and of course, as you can see from experience, still isn't. For example, in 1903, the third conference of the Labour Representation Committee, which was, as you probably know, leading towards the formation of the PLP, took place in Newcastle. Purely a coincidence, we happen to be in Newcastle now. And at that conference in Newcastle, in 1903, 83 years ago, Keir Hardie stated, "We have fixed upon a common denominator that when acting in the House of Commons, we will neither be Liberals, Tories, nor Socialists, but a Labour Party." And two of the earliest members of the Labour Party, or and the Labour movement in that sense, Jimmy Maxton and A.J. Cook, wrote a pamphlet called Our Case for a Socialist Revival, in which they stated, quite revealingly, "The new Labour Party programme must be regarded not as a socialist programme, but an enlightened liberal programme. If every measure in the Labour Party programme was carried, then we would not have socialism, but rationalised capitalism." Now, you can't have it clearer than that, straight from the horse's mouth. And in fact, whether it's the Labour Party, or whether it's CND, or any other movement which sets out to reform capitalism rather than abolishing it, they fail. In fact, on every single issue where reformism, or the modification of the system, has been tried, it's failed, without exception. The attempt to control capitalism over the past 100 years has proved to be a miserable and pathetic flop. And therefore, it is patronising in the extreme for politicians to tell us in 1986 that we must try these policies yet again rather than going for the socialist alternative. And let's go back into history for a minute or two. In 1929, the Labour Minister of Employment, sorry, that was an unintentional joke, J.H. Thomas, admitted that he was seeking to reduce unemployment, quote, "whilst accepting the present order of society." Year later, unemployment had jumped by 1 million. 40 years later, the chairman of the Parliamentary Labour Party, in 1967, said of the Labour government of that time, and I quote from the Times, 5th of April, 1967, "Never has any previous government done so much in so short a time to make modern capitalism work." Now, the Labour Party's record of trying to patch up or reform the capitalist system, rather than get rid of it, as the Socialist Party was advocating right from the start, clearly doesn't need much going over, because I think we're all pretty familiar with it. We know, for example, that the Labour Party has been a recruiting sergeant in two world wars, from 1914 onwards, urging workers to slaughter one another for the sake of the imperialist interests of their bosses. We know, for example, that the Labour Party introduced the British atom bomb in government after the war. We know they've broken strikes without number, from the 1951 Dockers strike to Grumley in 77 and onwards. We know that the Labour Party set up the Special Patrol Group. They invented those uniform thugs in government. We know that in one of the other eight Labour governments of capitalism, they passed the first overtly racist legislation in the 1964 and 5 Commonwealth Immigrants Acts to keep blacks out. We know that every single Labour government has promised before it was elected to solve the unemployment problem. And we know that since 1924, every single Labour government has left office with unemployment higher than when they went into office. Now, these are incontrovertible facts, and therefore, for people to come to us on the left today and say, ah, yes, but give us one more chance, because if you don't, a few Labour MPs might be joining the dole queue. Well, that doesn't wash any longer. The idea of nationalisation, which perhaps is the linchpin of left-wing reformism within capitalism, has never succeeded in changing the workers' position. You've got the statement in the NCB report from 1984. The National Coal Board should aim to maximise its long-term profitability. What is this? What difference is it from an ordinary private company? No difference whatsoever. But it doesn't have to just be the Tories. In fact, under the Labour government during the mid-70s, you had the chairman of the Post Office Board quoted in the Times, 25th of July, 78, as saying, "We are proud to make a profit in all of our businesses and intend to go on doing so." As for the activity of closing pits, well, the Labour governments of the 60s only closed 340 pits, only made 300,000 miners redundant. Does that mean the NUM is going to withdraw its funding of the Labour Party? That's the question we would put. And let me quote from Hansard, Parliamentary Reports, an earlier government minister dealing with the miners. He says, "I've never found the NUM in any way unreasonable where closures are necessary because of exhaustion or," and this is the key part, "or because pits are out of line in economic terms." Remember the famous phrase of 84? Economic reasons. No, never found them unreasonable for such closures. "What is needed," he goes on, "is a viable industry to get the coal out of the ground and get it out at competitive prices." Margaret Thatcher? No. Tony Benn, quoted in Hansard, volume 959, column 1015, when he was in power in the 1970s. So this kind of hypocrisy, as I say, doesn't wash at all, and therefore we're not interested in it. Now, the policies that are being put forward before you now, and I say this in conclusion, is a very simple choice. You can try if you want, yet again, and it would be a very foolish thing indeed to do, the old policies which have been tried and which have failed over and over, such as the Keynesian policy of higher government spending, which took place throughout the 70s. It didn't stop unemployment from quadrupling in the 70s. Or, on the other hand, you can actually go for the socialist alternative, which I've touched on all too briefly, but which will come out in further discussion. And the socialist alternative is blindingly simple. At the moment, according to reports from the United Nations, and I quote, "the surface of the earth has hardly been scratched." We couldn't put it better ourselves. There are vast untapped resources for production, and they won't be tapped for humanity unless we destroy the profit motive, because it's profit, as you well know, which dictates when you are allowed to produce and when you may not produce in the present world. And you're not going to get rid of the profit motive by electing a few more pleasant, smiling bureaucrats to number 10 who will put industry in the hands of their state, just like the NCB did, and who will run industry for profit on a bureaucratic, perhaps Russian-style basis. The fact is, Russia, Yugoslavia, British Leyland, British Coal, as it's now called, the modern name, all of these institutions are part of capitalism, and therefore what we've got to do is to form a democratic political movement, which the seed already exists in the socialist movement, which I'm speaking on behalf of. But there needs to be a movement of workers getting together in very large numbers, with conscious and clear ideas in order to transform society. And the slogan, or slogans of that movement, have to be very simple. One I've mentioned, no compromise. You don't compromise with capitalist politicians or their futile ideas. And the other idea, which goes right back to Karl Marx and it's still valid, abolition of the wages system. Don't work for wages, because whilst you work for wages, you're a slave to the employer who receives profits, even if it's a state bureaucrat. What you've got to do instead of working for wages is work for each other. Have a cooperative commonwealth, a society across the world in which wealth is produced purely for need, purely for people to use because they're hungry, because they're cold, and without the slightest intention of the outdated process of buying and selling.
Thank you very much, Cliff.